Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Monday, kicking off your work week here, July the 23rd, 2018, 16 minutes past the hour. July 23rd, that's my brother's birthday and my grandparents' anniversary. One of those days in my family history that sprung many things. July 23rd is an important day, so happy anniversary and happy birthday to everybody who might be. One of my aunts had a birthday on July 23rd as well. She's no longer my aunt, but I liked her just the same. We have a good program coming up for you today, folks. If my voice holds up, my voice is a little raspy today. I don't know if we'll make the whole thing, but the good news is we have a guy on who's a great talker. He's one of my favorite guests. I don't think we've had him on since December, which is a shame, but there's a lot to talk about in the sports world and certainly in the world of President Trump. Always a pleasure to welcome to these microphones the best in-ring interview there ever was, as far as I'm concerned, former HBO boxing analyst Larry Merchant. Larry, how are you?
Thank you, Scott, for that generous introduction.
I every time I'm watching boxing to this day, Larry, I miss you. I miss you hitting them right after the fight.
Thank you.
Larry, the first thing I want to talk to you about before we get to our president and the situation he's involved in, something that involves the state you're in, California, and our state, is the loss of LeBron James. Is that a good move for him to leave Ohio at this point?
Well, that's up to him to say, and I suppose his career is winding down, and he's looking forward to his next life in the entertainment world, and so it makes sense from that point of view. He's had two great runs in Ohio. I think his coming back to Ohio was a great thing for the free agency that makes it difficult to follow teams from year to year very often in sports, because the players, just like the owners before them, have the right to move around. And while it's certainly a democratic way of looking at it, in sports it's sometimes difficult for communities that attach themselves to teams and stars and almost live emotionally through them. So it's been a up and down ride in Ohio, but I think he's done the state proud.
I think you're out, hit it right on the head there. Larry, one thing about boxing. I've heard recently that Pacquiao is challenging Mayweather again. Is there a fight in boxing now that people will pay the $50 to $70 cover charge pay-per-view to watch?
Well, yeah, there's the rematch that's coming up in September between Canelo Alvarez and Gennady Golovkin for the middleweight championship. They had a big showdown, I think it was last September, and it turned out to be, unlike most such showdowns, a real exciting fight. And I myself, as a sports fan and fight fan, can't wait to see the 13th round. And also looming on the horizon is a major heavyweight fight between the British heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua, who is a big personality and almost Ali-like in how his fans look at him, and an American, Deontay Wilder, who has an excellent record. And what I'm curious about is, well, what if Wilder should win, and we had an undefeated heavyweight champion again, the likes of which we haven't had in a quarter of a century, would we really respond to him? Does boxing in general and the heavyweight championship, which used to represent maybe the strongest man on the planet, the most powerful country on the planet, would it resonate as it once did in America?
You know, Larry, I look at boxing and certainly Ali, certainly Tyson, certainly I even remember Buster Douglas, Evander Holyfield, George Foreman, when he won the title at such a late age. People were still tuning in big numbers, still coming in big numbers. When did it change? When did the drop-off start to happen?
Well, most people looked at boxing through the prism of the heavyweight championship because all that it symbolized. They weren't necessarily boxing fans or even sports fans, but if there was an American champion, a Jack Dempsey, a Joe Louis, a Muhammad Ali, a George Foreman, etc., somehow it attracted them. They wanted to see what that guy looked like and who he was inside and outside and how he represented whatever he represented. But as I've said before, there are still hundreds of those guys around, but they're all playing linebacker someplace. And so the culture has shifted. Once upon a time, when we were an agrarian country, primarily people came out of the fields and the mines, and they went into local gyms just to exercise or prove their manhood or some such thing. And from the sheer numbers came excellence, and from excellence came champions and big crowds and so on. But times change. But boxing, like other sports and like virtue and entertainment, is now international, and there are some countries where it's still a very big deal, and it's not as big a deal in the firmament as it once was in America.
You know, it's interesting. I was just thinking, I do remember when Mike Tyson bit a piece of Evander Holyfield's ear off. I remember that being big news. I remember watching Foreman lose the title on a decision. I think that was an HBO fight. I don't think that was pay-per-view. But to me, when Foreman lost the title the second time, that's really when it tapered off for me to a great degree. I do remember the ear thing, but I don't think I bought that pay-per-view. There was just something when Foreman lost, the guy who beat, I can't even remember his name. And I think that's for me when it kind of changed.
Well, everybody has got their time. There are a lot of people who were Cleveland Indian fans who might have turned away from baseball when Bob Feller retired. It happens to us all, what their enthusiasms are when we're young, and how things change and evolve. That was a good period of time. But again, you're making my point, which you're talking about heavyweights. You were attracted by the heavyweights, American heavyweights, who dominated the 20th century in boxing. And some of them were big personalities and in important symbols, from Jack Johnson, and the first black champion, and Jack Dempsey, who came to represent in hindsight of his career how American power had magnified after World War I, and then Joe Louis, who became the first black hero when he beat a German heavyweight as Hitler was looming. And then after World War II, another Rocky Marciano, and Muhammad Ali, and the band Marches On. So that was the period you're talking about was the last great period of American heavyweights. But there have been many terrific American fighters in lower weight divisions. And in general, the center of boxing has shifted, and the tectonic plates have shifted to the southwest because of so many Mexican Americans out here, and boxing being such an important part of the popular culture in Mexico. The shorelines change, the rivers flood, and life goes on.
You know, Larry, and I might be wrong about this, but for me, what was going on at that particular time, from Rocky Marciano, Joe Louis, Ali, even up till the end of Foreman's second reign, there were two things there that I felt are lacking today in a lot of sports. And I think maybe it's by the last two World Series all of a sudden have rejuvenated baseball a little bit. It's that the people had charisma. When Foreman came back at a late date and he looked so different and he was working on the farm and he was announcing and he wanted to avenge the Ali loss and winning it older than anybody, that's a great story. And Foreman was charismatic. Ali, obviously charismatic. How fast was Mike Tyson going to knock somebody out being undefeated? There were well-told stories there, much like the Chicago Cubs. The stories aren't as... I don't know if it's the age we're in. They're just not as great as they once were. And the charisma seemed to have changed in people. I don't know...
I think you're correct. That said, a few years ago, when Mayweather fought Pacquiao, it generated multiples of the greatest audience in the history of the sport. It's now sort of like live theater and Broadway. Boxing is. That it's no longer a central part of popular culture, and that we communicate our stories through boxing, just as we would examine the good and the bad parts of our communities and our lives in live theater. But it still exists. It may have just a cult following this culture, but there are enough of them that there's probably more boxing on television than there ever has been before. But if you're not a fan, then it's just a click away from the next detective show.
Well,
in as far as Broadway is concerned, it's been buried many times as no longer being relevant to the society, and yet a Hamilton comes along, and it's like an Ali who came along to revive boxing in his time. So perhaps that will happen again. The history of these things is that it does. Boxing is very big in Great Britain, where it started over 200 years ago. And I would have never guessed there'd be such a revival as there has been in the last decade there. So some larger-than-life figure will materialize, and for a while it will seem like boxing is back, but it will never have the currency that it that it once did. It will never be in the dreams of young people that a way to deal with their circumstances to become a champion in boxing.
And before we leave that, there is one other component that is missing, in all honesty, the Howard Cosells and the Larry Merchants, which kept me there for a long time as well. So everybody's a cookie cutter now, it seems like, but people like you, Larry, boy, oh boy, I just wanted to see, well, Mayweather, yeah, you're a little dust up with him, classic television.
One never knows, do one. I can't hear you very well, Scott, so if you've got some piece of equipment there that can be turned up, please try.
I will do that. Is that a little better?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I want to move on to the NFL because the kneeling thing is getting a little out of hand. Kaepernick has felt the blow of it. The president likes to weigh in on it. What's your feeling on football players kneeling now being mandatory or stay in the locker room?
Well, look, obviously we live in a free country and they can do whatever they like. But when you're working for somebody, whether it's a bank or a ball team, you are impacting that business, and the question becomes not whether they're going to just allow you to do it because you are a free person, but whether they think it's good or bad for the business. So I go back in a day to remembering that I was covering a New York Knicks basketball game, I think the day after the Kent State massacre, when some soldiers shot some students who were protesting during the era of the Vietnam protests, shot and killed. And I can remember sitting at the press table and the Star Spangled Banner ceremony began. I had always been curious about just why Star Spangled Banner was played at ball games. But in any event, it was just almost an involuntary movement on the part of myself and others. I couldn't stand. I was so upset by what happened at Kent State that I couldn't stand. And I just sat there and I didn't make a big deal out of it, but I discovered, looking around and from what people told me later, that there were large numbers of people, fans, who were in their own way silently protesting this grotesque event at Kent State. So I, you know, if I were an athlete and I had some grievance and I felt emotionally that I had to express it somewhere and I choose to do it when there is an emotional appeal to our national symbols like the flag and like the Star Spangled Banner and so on, I applaud them, but there is a certain risk of a backfire.
You're exactly right there, Larry. I want to come to the president. Why do you think he has weighed in on that particular issue?
Because he thought it was with his intuition about the public, that he thought it would resonate with a lot of people. And it has.
When we look, well, let me start here. Last Monday, a week ago today, about this time, the president was having his 45-minute press conference with Vladimir Putin. What did you make of that, Larry?
Well, I just think it exposed him for really not understanding how international relations work, how he's been praising Putin since he started to run for office, how he has challenged our allies in Europe and Canada in treaties that have not only more or less kept the peace for 70 years, but have also enabled us to become as prosperous as we have during that time, because we haven't had any major wars, although we have been involved, unfortunately, in some relatively minor adventures in Asia and so on. And he just doesn't get it. He tells so many lies that he can't catch up with his own lies, and he's now first he lies, then he withdraws the lie, then he says it was a double negative and a quadruple negative, and his true believers just think, well, that's just him, and it's the media looking to create some trouble and so on. So here's a man who creates fake news and then challenges those people who report it for reporting the fake news. It's a circular firing squad kind of activity, and it's conservatives from all over the country are embarrassed by him. His own cabinet members have lately routinely challenged him. You're talking about the meeting with Putin. Well, the head of the CIA and our defense secretary both challenged him on it. So it's not just crazy liberals and educated people who are parsing his words. One of the things the president is supposed to do is be able to understand what his words do. And his words, to me, suggest that he thinks his followers aren't very bright because they can't follow him.
Well, Larry, the Russia thing was particularly interesting because during the meeting he said he would have no reason to believe that Russia tampered in the last election. Then the next day, as you said he meant to say wouldn't. It was a double negative. And then 18 hours ago, this was his tweet, he said, so President Obama knew about the Russian knew about Russia before the election. Why didn't he do something about it? Why didn't he tell our campaign? Because it's all a big hoax. That's why he thought Crooked Hillary is going to win. So he says one thing, then he says he didn't say that, and then he goes back to the original. Why is he so flip-floppy on this particular thing?
As I've said before, in his heart of hearts, he's just a salesman. And he'll say whatever he thinks will make the sale at that moment. And if for some reason he says something that upsets people, including people that he has chosen to help run the government, his own people who challenge him. And sometimes he says, well, I didn't mean it. I left out the comma. It was a joke. And instead of us concentrating on the substance of policy and what can affect our lives, we wind up trying to interpret what he means. And does he mean what he say? Does he say what he means? And that's, you know, if you're a news person or a news outlet, how can you avoid saying the president just said this and then he did that and then his own party is criticizing him about the other thing? And it's a lot of noise to listen to or read and I saw a lot of people just shut down and say, well, I like him, I don't care, that's just him. And a lot of other people are scared to death that he's going to do something really stupid rather than just say stupid stuff all the time.
Well, in this particular case, if you put your mind in the mind of a Trump voter, if you put your mindset there, what is particularly interesting about this is all the other things he has said about John McCain, Hillary Clinton, President Obama, even Kim Jong-un, called him Rocket Man at one point. Even if you didn't like what he was saying, you knew why he was saying it. The thing with Putin is, I don't understand the why, because we know what Putin did. And I just don't...
Well, that's a question. Some people believe that Putin and the Russian government have something on him. That it may have been about some of his financial adventures and misadventures with borrowing money from Russian oligarchs. It may have been something personal, but there's a general sense that he's acting guilty. And the way he approaches it is to say that the American government, the deep state, is against him. Well, I call him the shallow state. And I trust the government, in this case, the FBI and the CIA. If they're challenging his assertions and looking into his records, who am I going to believe? A guy who's a virtually proven grifter? Or am I going to listen to the case that... they're trying to make on him, and he's trying to change the narrative so that we don't believe our own government. We only believe in one man, and that's the king. We elected a king. Incidentally, you were mentioning heavyweights before, and I read an article somewhere about how one of his heroes was Mike Tyson, and the whole hip hop movement, and how you can achieve a certain kind of power no matter how psychologically untethered you may be, and so put that under your hat and think about it.
You know, Larry, one of the first places the general public got introduced to President Trump was boxing. He was at these events. They were in his casinos, in his buildings. What was the general feeling about Donald Trump in those days amongst the boxing community?
Well, nobody... The feeling was is that Donald Trump, by building and taking over several hotels in Atlantic City where gambling was legal, was trying to capture the glamour of Las Vegas, where many of the big sporting events, especially boxing, had taken place over the last half century. And he was just a curiosity. Then his attachment with Don King and Mike Tyson became known, and then he won a bidding war for a fight between Foreman and Holyfield to bring to Atlantic City, which was a hot thing at the time. And he outbid everybody by double, some outrageous sum at that time. And then as the fight came into view, it turned out that the deep government of boxing, if it could be called that, was right all along, that there was no way the fight could generate enough money to justify the bid he had made. And what he did was he imposed the War Act and the contract. This had happened around the time of 9/11, I believe. And we had gone into Afghanistan. I don't remember the exact point of time, or Iraq. And he just took the war clause that's in a lot of contracts that gives somebody an out in case the country gets into a war, and decided he can only pay half as much as he had agreed to pay. And they took it. He had outwitted the boxing establishment. That was him, and he was around, and I hung out in groups with him a few times, and he was a big, nice-looking guy, and didn't have much to say about boxing, except he knew that Mike Tyson, for a few moments in time, was a very powerful figure in America, and he latched on to him, and that's how he got into the business. Here's something I wanted. I found, since we've last talked, something that to me explains a lot of things. Joseph Heller wrote Catch 22, one of the most famous American novels of the 20th century. I think it came out around 1960 or so. And I want to read a quote from that book. "It was almost no trick at all to turn vice into virtue and slander into truth, impotence into abstinence, arrogance into humility, plunder into philanthropy, thievery into honor, blasphemy into wisdom, brutality into patriotism, and sadism into justice." Think about the Mexico border situation. "Anybody can do it. It required no brains at all. It merely required no character."
That says a lot. You know, Larry, when you were in these groups with him, what was the essence of the man?
I don't know. He was acting like the promoter, and in a way he was. He was putting the event on with Don King, and he deferred to King, who was a nonstop talker and hyper and salesman, and turned himself into, you know, this circus master. And when he put on a fight, he became at least the co-star of the fight, and frequently just the star of the fight himself, which is a kind of an American version of what many promoters are. So anyone who was around King was around King, was in the shadows somehow. And as I've said to you, if Don King was born rich and white, he'd be Trump, and if Trump was born poor and black, he'd be King.
Mm. You know, Don King, he's still with us. He's still out there around and about. What was his great appeal to the boxing community?
Well, his great achievement, and I was a sports columnist in New York at the time when he came along. I think it was in the 70s. And I thought, hey, here's this interesting personality. Many, if not most, of the top fighters were black. Isn't it time that there was a black promoter? So I became very interested in him and supportive of him. And in Madison Square Garden, which was the major boxing entity of that time, was a little heavy-footed, and he was running around and signing people and making fights and the like. And in a way, I celebrated him. But it turned out he was one of those promoters whom fighters, most of them black fighters, complained was cheating them out of their money. And that's when things turned. But he was unstoppable. He became a kind of caricature of what a promoter should be, and he was all over television. And here's an odd thing. I once decided in my post-fight interviews that it was really useless interviewing promoters after fighters, that all they were trying to do was sell their fighters. They tell us how great their fighters are. And I thought, this is a waste of time. I'd rather be talking to the fighters themselves. Well, not long after that, there was a fight that was a pay-per-view fight, and Don King had it inserted into the contract that I had to interview him after the fight. And it's the kind of thing, it's the kind of thing that suggested to me he understands the power of the medium. He understands that being this larger-than-life character with the outfits he wore and the hair and so on, both him and Trump, incidentally, both of these big guys with strange hair, whatever that means. And it was his act. And that's how he sold himself, his event, and he needed that airtime desperately. Well, we have a president who needs to tweet to try to dominate the conversation. He needs to do it desperately. And when the president of the United States is saying things real and unreal and imagined and weird, it's going to start a conversation, not just locally or nationally, but internationally. I mean, how do we account for a president who sucks up to a murderous dictator and sucks down on our allies all over the world? You tell me.
And that is the quandary we're in. That's the question. Why talk down to the Prime Minister of Germany and Great Britain and be okay with Putin? Maybe one day we'll know the answer, but it's an interesting
point. Well, maybe that's why he is keeps telling us that Robert Mueller's investigation is a hoax and fake news, and everything he can to change the narrative and to undermine our intelligence agencies, so that when a verdict or a finding of some kind finally emerges, if it's not favorable to him, he can say, these are enemies of the state. They're not the state. I'm the state.
You know, that the day that Mueller's investigation comes out, I worry about that day, because when the last indictment came out, I thought it was particularly significant, because anybody who read it, it said two things that were highly important. Number one, that the day that President Trump, candidate Trump then, said look for Hillary's emails, they did. And also, they, not through Facebook, through voting areas, got 500,000 people plus. They got their information from the voting areas, and the investigation is still going on. How close are we to saying that votes were actually changed, that people were targeted? And when it comes down, if it's negative to Trump, not only are you going to have the people who are waiting for that to happen, you're going to have the people who defend him no matter what. And I don't know what will happen on that day. What do you foresee, Larry?
That's what we've been building toward. And I have no answers. I don't know where all the evidence leads. I don't know whether it's going to have to do with laundered money and taxes and relationships. I don't know that you can prove certain charges, whether you can build a circumstantial case for interfering with our elections, as well as a hard case. These are legal matters, and I would just point out that the people in charge of the investigation are all Republicans. I wonder how that will matter to Trump supporters, or are they just part of the deep state? By the way, I think we have a pretty good deep state, and I think that Ohio, with deep state politicians like Kasich and Brown, suggest there is hope and that this too shall pass.
You know, one thing of note we should mention, after the Putin-Trump summit last week, Hillary Clinton all of a sudden reappeared and is speaking at a lot of places, also said she would help reunite these immigrant families with their children. She's back on the scene pretty heavy this week, all of a sudden. Timing is interesting.
Well, I hadn't noted much. To me, this is one of those situations where politically, when your opponent or opponents are having a rough time, all you have to do is get out of the way. You don't have to. You don't. don't have to make it a partisan battle. And this isn't a partisan battle, except we have a lot of tribalism in our country, and a lot of people who believe what they believe or don't believe what they don't believe, and nothing can change that. And so we're involved in a narrative and a story that could wind up to be deeply disturbing, and I'm just wondering how our so-called deep state will handle that.
Well, interestingly enough, and maybe we'll end on this note, as it stands right now, on November 2nd, President Trump has extended the invitation for Vladimir Putin to come to America. November 7th are the midterm elections, and November 10th is the military parade, which we've never had. Again, timing. To invite the man who we have proof fiddled with the election to the country 5 days before the election? I don't know. Do you?
Well, it's almost beyond reality that a president of the United States would invite the head of a foreign adversary to come to influence an election. I think that it's being set up for Putin to throw some kind of a bone to Trump, to help build his and support him, because recent by-elections have shown that it's possible that the Democrats will retake the House of Representatives, at least. And so he's using all of the power of the bully pulpit by bringing in the biggest bully in the world to help him. It's not in the civics books, I'll put it that way.
Well, here's what I know. 3 months till Putin comes in, 3 months till the midterm elections, which could change the House and the Senate, and Mueller could drop at any time. This is going to be an interesting 3 months. And the thing about the Mueller investigation is nobody will see the end coming. I mean, I imagine one day it'll just be there.
Well, they've been very professional and tight-lipped about what their discoveries have been. The indictments and other charges that have come out have been only after the most thorough of investigations, and so if anybody is playing politics with this, it's certainly not Mueller, who, again, though respected on both sides of the aisle, is a long-standing Republican.
The absolute best person ever in the boxing business, broadcast side, Larry Merchant. Larry, it's always a pleasure. I can't wait to talk to you again. Thank you so much, as always.
Same thing here, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Veltone Building. Thank you so much for playing fair.